Hi, y'all. Welcome back, Borderly fam. This is Mario Carrillo, your host of Borderly, a four-part project of Immigrantly. We're here now on our fourth and final episode of Borderly, at least for now. And I just want to thank you for staying with me on this journey of learning more about the El Paso Juarez region. And you know, as we were putting this series together, there was something that kept sticking with me in our conversations. We kept talking about the border in so many different ways. It's history, it's memory, it's art. But underneath all of these conversations was a quieter question that lingered with me about who actually carries the weight of these stories and of what happens here on the border. In our first episode, we talked to Dr. Leyva about El Paso's rich history and how the border wasn't really meant to be a hard line, or at least the hard line that it's become now. In its history, we see that it was something that people lived across. It was something that was moved through relatively freely. Families built their lives around it. And that idea kept coming back to me. When I talked to Bob Moore, we talked briefly about family separation and the crisis it created. And I think it's important to remember that even though we are not a policy podcast, I think it's also important to note that the family separation crisis was not an abstract policy moment for those folks who lived here. As it was happening, it was something that happened here on the ground, something that people felt immediately. And then in our last episode with Patrick Gavaldon, we talked about art along the border, and it became clear to me, at least, how much of the art that we see here in El Paso and beyond is really in response to what happens after moments like family separation or after the tragic El Paso shooting. After the headlines move on and after the cameras are gone. So for this last conversation, it felt important for me to sit with someone who's been right in the middle of it all. Today's guest on our fourth episode of Borderly is Melissa M. Lopez, Executive Director of Estrella del Paso. She's from here. She grew up in our city. And she spent years working alongside families who are navigating immigration law, often at the exact moments when everything feels uncertain for them, when they aren't sure necessarily if they'll be able to stay in this country or not. We talk about what welcoming someone with dignity actually looks like day to day, not in theory, but as a practice. We talk about what 2018 felt like here on the ground, as the emergency was unfolding and how folks really came together to respond to that. And we talked about what it means to keep showing up. I think this is a nice place for this series to land. I don't think we'll have all the answers exactly, but hopefully after these conversations that we've had, we have a better sense of what it means to listen to the border, to the people who live here, who work here, who choose to raise their families here, and to ensure that we take those stories seriously. This is our conversation with Melissa, and this is Borderly. Lopez, how are you?
I'm doing well. Well, as well as we can be doing these days.
Yeah, no, you're right. We're speaking today in mid-January of 2026, and it already feels like it's been several years worth of work. So I really appreciate you taking the time and joining us here on our fourth and final installment of Borderly, at least for now. And I definitely want to talk about your role at Estrella that you've had now for many years as executive director?
Yes, I've been the executive director for 13 years now, but I've been with the agency for 18.
And it began as the Diocesan Migrant and Refugee Services back in 1986. We'll get to that part of your story as well, but I think one of the things that I really wanted to try and capture in the interviews that I've done and the stories that we've received is that not necessarily a conversation about policy, even though the policies that get drafted and passed thousands of miles away obviously have a major impact on how we live our lives here on the border. But I would really love to have these stories be much more about the humanity of the border and how we receive people. And I feel like Estrella has done that along with other organizations of welcoming people with dignity. But before we get to that part, I know that you're born and raised El Paso. So as someone who was raised here, not born here, I would love to get a sense from you, what was growing up here like for you, and what did it teach you about community growing up here in El Paso?
Gosh, everybody seems to know everybody in El Paso. So even though it's a fairly large city, right, we have a population of 800,000, it's so tight-knit in terms of, you know, you meet somebody and then they, you know, they have a connection to somebody else you know. I was mentioning to you briefly that I met somebody when I first went off to college who it turns out is best friends with my godson's godfather. And so to have, you know, this person that I met like over 20 years ago now be part of like, you know, the circle of friends that gets together on a regular basis, but that's just El Paso for you, right? You have 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. I think we have like 3 degrees of El Paso because everybody seems to know somebody. The reason I've always been in El Paso is for the community. I love this community. And I think growing up, you know, people were so quick to be like, oh, there's nothing to do in El Paso. And I can't wait to get out of El Paso. And I always knew I wanted to come back. It was never a question of leaving and then never coming back. So yeah, I love the community. I love the people. I love the fact that we have some of the conveniences of a larger city, but we don't have things like traffic. But we have this amazing community of people that you can turn to when you need somebody or you need something, which you don't get in larger cities. I think especially in times of need, we really stand up for each other, which is important.
Yeah, and I think that's been one of the major themes that have been overarching over the episodes that we've done, is that there's this deep sense of community. Because it honestly feels, at least for me, that we're on what sometimes feels like an island. We're not that close to other major cities, so we're really all we've got, and that includes the Juarez area and Las Cruces and New Mexico as well. For you, growing up here, when did you realize, or was there a moment that it, you know, something happened that it dawned on you that you grew up on the border? I think one of the things that I've experienced is that, you know, when you're a kid, you're growing up here, you're driving on I-10, you see Mexico on the other side. There's nothing that novel to it because we're used to it. But I think when you leave and you tell people where you're from, there is that more of like, wow, what's that like? What do you mean there's a country just 10 minutes away from where you grew up? So was there a moment when you were young that you kind of realized, oh yeah, I live on a border community?
You know what? It wasn't until I was an adult, really, that I realized the distinction. You know, growing up, there was a fence, really, not a wall. People would regularly swim in the river, right? We had more water in the river then. So people would swim in the river and, you know, you would see Border Patrol, but not like the way that we do now. And so it was very different. I mean, it felt like one big community, right? This distinction about the border. And I think even understanding like the ports of entry and what that meant, right? Like, I just remember we used to go to Juarez every Friday night for dinner growing up, right? Like, that was just what we did. We went to, you know, a few of the same restaurants, like El Taconazo was one of like the main restaurants that we were always going to in Juarez. And, you know, so I have like these very distinct memories, right? Like going to quinceañeras and weddings and just, you know, weekends to hang out with family. I didn't realize what it meant to live on the border until I went away to law school, to be honest with you, because I didn't really travel much. You know, as a kid, we traveled to like California, right, to Disneyland. But they were always like huge family trips. So there wasn't much interaction beyond that. And then we have family in Baja California, and so we would go there. And same thing, but the ports of entry and like the border never was like anything special or different, right? And then in high school, I got a chance to go to Canada, to Toronto. And I do remember crossing like the Canadian border and then it being like so nonchalant, like you just walked across. And I was like, well, this is different. But again, it just didn't ever dawn on me, like these divisions of countries and borders. And then I went to law school and was living in Austin. And it dawned on me when I came back home that in that first semester, I didn't see a single Border Patrol vehicle while I was in Austin. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh man, this is different. Like I'm used to like, we're on the Border Patrol. And then it's like, oh, well, duh, it's not a border, right? Mm-hmm. We're not right on the border. And so I think that's when it started to click for me. And then I got involved in doing immigration work in law school, not intending for that to be my career, but got involved in the issues and started to become more aware of it. And then, you know, that's when I think I started to think back to some of the experiences that I had, realizing what it was like to grow up on the border. But I think that's one of the beautiful things about El Paso is like, we don't see borders here. Like we don't see, I think we grew up really in a beautiful way because like even color, we don't see color. Like I felt my first sense of discrimination when I left El Paso for my family members. You know, I have a family that is Black and, you know, they've going other places have experienced, you know, being called the N-word and things like that. But El Paso was just like such a welcoming community that these differences back then didn't matter.
No, I think that's right. And I think I've touched on this on other episodes too, of what it was like in the 90s. And I think it's difficult to paint a real accurate picture because of the myths and misconceptions and the coverage of the media of what El Paso is, to know that it really was for a long time a very binational community where you could not tell where one began and the other started. And obviously as border enforcement and immigration enforcement has grown tremendously over the last 25, 30 years, it seems like that division between El Paso and Juarez is now a lot more stark, and it's a lot more visible, and it's a lot more even apparent when you're here on the ground. And I love that you touched on one of the themes as well that has rang true to me, is that leaving is when I fully understood what it was like to grow up on the border. But I think it also comes with the component of that you're not going to meet many people who are from the border or from El Paso. So for them, all they have are the misconceptions and the myths and whatever it is that's happening in the media during that time. So I'm wondering, as law school was the first time you ventured out beyond those 2 weeks in Western Massachusetts, where you immediately came back to El Paso. I love that, by the way. What was that like? And did you feel like you had to represent an entire community when you were in law school there in Austin? And what did others think about El Paso at that time?
You know what? The wonderful thing about going to law school in Austin at UT was that there was a contingency of people from El Paso. Like there were 10 to 20 of us between the various classes at any given time. And so it was great. We had like our El Paso community, that group of people that understood. But the other thing that was really wonderful was that there were a lot of people from the Rio Grande Valley, from the RGV. And so they understood what being on the border was like too. My very good friends from law school is from Laredo. And, you know, in talking to him, like our stories were so similar, right? Like we could really relate to each other. It was nice because we were still in Texas, I think. I will tell you, when I first tried to leave right out of high school, went to a small liberal arts college in Western Mass, Massachusetts. I was there for 2 weeks and went to the dean and was like, this is not working out. And he was like, I've never had a student like this early on know themselves well enough to know they're not going to be happy. So if you can get out of your dorm, this was a Tuesday. He's like, if you can get out of your dorm by Thursday morning, I'll give you all your tuition back. And I was like, done. So packed up my bags, put everything in boxes, shipped it home and came home. But it was different going to Massachusetts. I mean, this was one of the top liberal arts colleges in the country. And I remember people asking me if we rode horses to school. What? Like, this is what people envision about Texas generally.
Right. And you said, of course we do every day.
And then I was like, yeah, if only I was like, I'm super allergic to horses. So if we rode horses to school every day, I'd be in a real tough spot.
Oh my goodness. That is
go. You look unreal.
No, seriously, you look unreal.
The jeans are jeaning.
That top, top him.
You're legally not allowed to doubt yourself right now.
If our double dates don't audibly gasp when we walk in, we're leaving.
Immediately.
And babe, just order the burger. No one's impressed by a salad in 2026. We left that energy in the pandemic.
Okay, so flirt outrageously.
Hydrate aggressively.
And whatever happens, remember,
you are iconic.
Tinder double date. Who are you bringing? Download Tinder now.
So funny. So you go to law school, you take some immigration courses, but you do not think that's going to be your career at that moment. So before getting into your full career after law school, I would love to go back a little bit to your family's own story. One of the things that I found really interesting about your bio is that the organization that you've now been running for 13 years, Estrella del Paso, once actually helped your dad early on in the organization's history. So I would love to get a sense of not only what kind of support they might have, you know, given your dad at that point, but what was life like for them? Were they also residents of the border, or what stories did they tell you about growing up?
My mom, I was born in Juarez, but my mom's family came to the U.S. when she was 3. So she really doesn't remember living in Mexico. Right. My dad, on the other hand, was an orphan. His parents dropped him at an orphanage when he remembers having siblings, but he doesn't remember much about his family, his parents. It's a painful thing. So I think that fear of like, what happens if they don't want me, or they don't, you know, want to know anything about me. So anyway, he grew up in an orphanage. They put him out on the streets at 14, which was common for that time. And so he lived on the streets of Juarez for a number of years. And then he met these people that were from El Paso that he calls his family, but they were just, you know, strangers that took him in and cared for him and, you know, treated him like a family for the first time in his life. And so he ended up coming to the U.S. This family happened to live a few blocks from my grandma, my mom's mom.
Oh, wow.
And so my grandma met him and then eventually introduced him to my mom. And the rest, as they say, is history. And so my parents, they got married after a little bit after I was born. And finally started the process to get him his residency. And so, of course, you know, because he had entered without permission, he had to go back to Mexico and apply through Mexico. And so DMRS helped him with that whole process of going through the application process and then walking him through what things would be like in Juarez. At the time, they actually did allow you to have people go with you to the consulate. And so, and my mom remembers, it was kind of weird how it came up, because I started working there. And then eventually one day I was like, you know, like a year in, my mom was like, hey, where was the office before it, where it is now? And I was like, oh, we used to be right next to St. Patrick's. She's like, that's where your dad went when we got his residency. And I was like, what? So, yeah, they helped him get his residency. This was in, organization started in 86. This was, gosh, it had to have been like 86, 87. At one point we were, you know, destroying files in the basement, doing like a major destruction of files, because we had like 20 years worth of files at that point. And so I told everybody jokingly, I was like, okay, if you come across a file and you see somebody who looks just like me, but is a man, take that file. That's my dad's file. We never found it. And then we helped him a few years ago, represented him so that he could finally get his naturalization. So he's now a naturalized citizen.
Oh, that's beautiful. You know, and for a story that obviously began as difficultly as it did for your dad, to now have him be a citizen, what a wonderful ending to that story. And what was life like for them when they were growing up, even as they were meeting? What was El Paso for them, and what did it mean?
My mom, you know, grew up not really speaking Spanish, even though that was her native language, because in schools, they weren't allowed to speak Spanish. They would get physically assaulted, you know, they would get paddled if they spoke Spanish. So it's gotten to a point where my Spanish has kind of surpassed her Spanish, because she lived in a world where Spanish wasn't allowed. And so she didn't teach us Spanish. You know, my dad spoke Spanish. We spoke Spanish to him, but it was a very like pocho, very like, you know, slang Spanish. So it was really difficult, because growing up, communicating, like with my dad, especially without having that strong Spanish background, was not always easy. And we fought a lot. We are very similar. I look just like my dad, but you know, personality wise, we're also very similar. And so it was really hard because we would butt heads and then we couldn't really communicate, I think, as well as perhaps, you know, I think if we could have, if I had spoken Spanish then, I think maybe things would have been different, but it was tough. You had my dad coming in speaking Spanish, and really the only time he felt comfortable speaking English was after he had a drink or two. And that's, I think, common for people, that feeling of like, if I don't say the right thing, people are going to judge me. And I still get that today. People all the time are like, I want to naturalize, but I don't feel comfortable with the English.
And that's a big one for them, huh?
It's huge. It's huge. And it's all a mental thing. So I tell them, okay, go to Walmart. The cashier is not going to care what language. Tell them, I want to practice my English. They're going to practice with you. They're not going to tell you you're wrong. They're not going to correct you. But it's just about getting comfortable. So two totally different, you know, ways of growing up. My dad, you know, feeling that embarrassment because he didn't speak English. And then my mom, you know, not being able to speak Spanish because she would get in trouble. I really didn't learn Spanish until probably I was in college when I really started to kind of get a grasp for it.
And I think their story is one that's so interesting in how unique it is, where your mom had the quintessential, grew up in the U.S., spoke English during a time when speaking Spanish was certainly frowned upon, as you mentioned, yet your dad speaking Spanish all the time. And I feel like that's something that so many of us can relate to. You know, God bless my parents. We've been here in this country now almost 40 years, and neither one of them has really taken up English, and they speak primarily Spanish, exclusively Spanish. So that's how I learned the language too. But I think it also speaks to how in El Paso, you can kind of get away with that. You know, there's probably not too many places in the country where you can still have an understanding, still feel like you're a part of a community, even if you don't speak the language that most folks speak, because it's just so common here. So that's a fascinating part of it. And you did introduce us to one word that I'm surprised it's taken us this long, honestly, here on this podcast, the pocho. And we'll do a little bit of an aside here for folks who might be tuning in and who are not from El Paso, but how would you define pocho? Because in my mind, I have it so neatly defined. And I also come from a family where Spanglish is the norm. So I would just love for our listeners to get a sense of what that means.
The best way to describe pocho for me anyway is like, it's the person who doesn't speak either language well and is trying their best to communicate with the person from the other language. So for example, the proper term for parking is estacionamiento, right? Or estacionar, so to park, right? But people in El Paso would say like parquear. So they would take the English park and then just make it sound Spanish. And so that, and then I remember, basically my mom had a friend that really didn't speak Spanish, but she would try really, really hard. And so she would say, you just add an O to the end of a word and that makes it Spanish. And so it's kind of, I feel like it's that attempt by people to learn Spanish, but they're really not quite grasping it. So you just kind of come up with your own words and everybody knows what they are. Like if you say parquear, people are like, yeah, I know what you're talking about. It's not the proper term. You say parquear when you're in New York City, they are going to be like, what are you talking about?
And I think one of the other things too is the Spanglish, right? Where we have an ability to start a sentence in one language and midway switch to the other. And then by the time we finish, come back to the other. And I think, at least for me, I'll speak for myself. At first, it almost felt like, why can't we just speak one of them, you know? But now I almost feel it as like a sense of pride that feels like such a way of growing up on the border and having that be the norm. Like, I love my sister to this day, but she speaks that way. And she also came when she was older. So I kind of understand it, where English was not her first language, but now she's been working predominantly in English. So I understand kind of where that comes from, but I wonder if that's true for others as well. But thank you for that quick aside on pocho.
And I think what it is that you get to a point where you can think in another language. I think once you master thinking in a different language, what I find is sometimes, and my grandma used to say, speak in English or speak in Spanish, but don't mix the two.
Yeah.
She was very adamant about you don't mix the languages. Like, you don't do Spanglish. But what I find now is that sometimes there are Spanish words that just better reflect what you're trying to say, or vice versa. Sometimes you have to throw it in because you're trying to make a point and you know that the other person speaks both languages, right? So you're like, okay, I'm going to make this point. Because, you know, there's things like the word love in Spanish has always been, like, there's so many ways to say love. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but love in English is like such a strong word. Like, you say it to somebody and it has like this very clear meaning. In Spanish, te quiero, te amo. Like, there's so many different ways to say it that I'm like, no, love in English is like a very clear example of that for me.
That's very cool. Thank you for that. No, and I love that. I love these conversations. I haven't had the chance yet on others to kind of just branch out and talk a little bit more about what makes our own cultural experience a little bit more unique. Back to a little bit of your story, which is something that I've talked to each of our other guests about so far, is that all of you left El Paso for one reason or another, for a certain amount of time over another. I know Dr. Leyva at UTEP actually left multiple times, but always found herself back. Patrick left for law school as well, much like you. So when you left and you were going through your experience of law school, did you always know that you would come back, even if you didn't know exactly what your career would end up becoming? Or did you want to continue exploring more? Or how did that journey back happen for you?
You know, I always knew I wanted to come back. You know, growing up, people always said, oh, there's something to do in El Paso. Like, I can't wait to get out of this place. And for me, it was always like, well, El Paso is a great place. Like, there's so much about El Paso that I love. I love the way we treat people. I love the community. There's so much about it that I love. And if we want to make it better, then we have to come back and contribute to the community. So I always knew I wanted to come back. It's interesting because I was thinking about it and having this conversation with my friend that stayed at the school in Massachusetts. If I had stayed, I don't know that I would have made my way back. At that point, given how young I was, I probably would have left and never come back. But because I was a little bit older when I left, I knew what the community had to offer. And so I always wanted to come back and knew that this was where I wanted to build my career. And it's interesting because now I'm reaching a point where I'm ready to explore more. I do a lot of traveling for work. So I've seen a lot of the US, but I want to travel and I want to see other parts of the world. I got to go to Italy for work in November. And that was like, just like the most incredible like opportunity that I never would have imagined I would have gotten. And it makes me like emotional to think about it because it was like such a cool experience. And now I'm like, okay, where am I going to go next? What am I going to do next in terms of trying to explore? Because I also feel like that's important for us, right? We have to go out. We have to see what's out there. We have to see ways that we can make our community better and then bring those ideas back.
How did your time at law school essentially lead you to beginning your time at Estrella? And what were you doing at that point? And what was the climate like? Because, I mean, I know it wasn't that long ago in terms of years, but honestly, over 1 year, so much changes here. So I'm just curious, what was it that initially brought you through Estrella, then DMRS? And then what was your role back then? And how has it evolved over time?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I say I'm Catholic. And so I say it was God. You could call it fate, you know, whatever it is. But I was in law school and I was going to go work for another nonprofit. 2 weeks before graduation, they reached out and said, look, the grant that we were going to use to pay you didn't come through. So I didn't have a job. I had done the immigration clinic twice in law school and enjoyed it, but didn't particularly feel like it was something that I was called to do. But I told my clinic professor, I was like, look, I just lost my job. So if you hear anything. And so in the first week of bar study, and I get a call from my clinic professor saying, hey, there's a nonprofit in El Paso that's hiring. Are you interested? And I said, well, yeah, I need a job. And she's like, it's doing immigration work. And I'm like, sign me up. So did an interview with the then executive director, Ileana Origin, who's now a county commissioner. We talked about the organization a little bit. And so hung up the conversation with a job offer. And I'm like, okay, I'm coming home. So studied for the bar, moved back to El Paso, started working at DMRS at the time as a staff attorney, handling removal defense cases. And I can tell you that I think back to what the work was like, 18 and a half years ago. And it's like night and day to the way that it is now. You know, I always took the perspective that the people on the other side, the judge, the government attorneys, ICE, you know, Border Patrol, the people at the bridges, that this was a job for them in the same way that I was doing a job, right? Mm-hmm. And so I always would try to treat people as human beings first. So walk into court, how are you doing? And I have to say, like, a lot of us had very congenial relationships at the time. Like, we knew about each other's families and knew about people who had kids. The craziest thing that people still don't believe is that at the time that I started, you know, we don't have discovery, which is something that is available in almost every other type of law that you practice, which is where you know what the other side has. You're not walking into court blind. That's never existed in immigration court. But here in El Paso, we were allowed to look at files. So I could make an appointment, go to the immigration office, the attorney's office, and they would let me look through my client's files. I knew everything that they had in their file before court. We weren't walking into court blind in terms of what we were up against. And it made for a much more productive system. Even the judges, they'd be like, you know what, go have a conversation, go talk. You know, it was only 18 and a half years ago. And so I started working during the first Bush administration, and then Obama, Trump 1, Biden, and now Trump 2. And by and large, things didn't change dramatically between Bush and Obama in terms of the way that we worked with each other. Change came under Trump 1. And then, of course, what we're seeing now, which is like a complete erosion of the system. But yeah, it was just completely, completely different back then. We had, as a matter of fact, we had a case that we took in of a family with an incredibly, incredibly sick child. The child needed to travel to have, you know, pretty much life-saving treatment outside of El Paso. But the family had entered with border crossing cards and had to stay because the child got so sick. This would never happen today, but we actually went to the immigration service and was like, look, these people have a very sick child. We need you to actually put them into deportation proceedings. We would never do that now. This family, finally, after all these years, they finally got their residency about 3 months ago.
No, that's very interesting in terms of how much things have changed. And I think you touch on something that we don't have to dive very deep into, but in terms of doing the type of work that you do or your team of attorneys or even shelters like Annunciation House, there's always a level, or has been at least, of some sort of participation, and because there has to exist between orgs like y'all's and the Border Patrol, for example. There has to be an understanding. And I remember a conversation with Ruben a couple of years ago, how Border Patrol would call him and they would let him know, you know, we've picked up this many people and they need a place to stay. So for people like Ruben, it made sense to have a good relationship with Border Patrol, which I think for people outside of El Paso might just be like, why would you even try? But even that, to an extent, I'm sure has been incredibly different and difficult too. So I think that's just one of those things about the border that people not living in it wouldn't understand just how much Border Patrol law enforcement is in your life. Like, we have family members, we have loved ones, we have primos, we have people who we care deeply about who go down these roles. And there's always been some sort of respect, but it seems like it's changed quite a bit over the last like 8 or 10 years, right?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, the reality is that law enforcement is the way out of poverty in El Paso, you know, especially federal law enforcement. And so we have a lot of people that have gone that route because that is the best way to support their family. And again, that's why I always took the perspective, you know, I knew people who worked in Border Patrol. I knew people who worked for ICE. And it was never something that you felt like, okay, that we're all making political choices in that way, right? It felt like, okay, we're making these choices because the system forced us to work together. Like, I had ICE agents cell phone numbers. And I had, you know, cell phone numbers for people that worked for the government attorney's office. The same thing with the Bridges, because that was the best way to serve our clients, is to have those relationships with them. And now it's been really difficult because, like, I know in my heart of hearts that some of these individuals really would like to help, but they can't. Their hands are tied. And the thing that I have to force myself to remember sometimes, and, you know, it, I know it's really difficult because it's gotten so heated right now, but there are a lot of people who have been with the federal government their entire careers. And many of them, what people don't realize is that they have to work 20 years before they can retire. They don't fulfill their full 20 years, they completely lose their retirement. I know for a fact that there are people who are currently and have stayed in these government positions because they're 6 months, a year, year and a half away from retirement. So it's a very complicated issue, is I guess what I'm trying to get at.
Focusing a bit on the work that Estrella does, and I would love to hear about the programs that y'all have. I think at its core, and I'm curious what you think, but Estrella is about welcoming people with dignity. And obviously you're running into people who at that time might be at the lowest point of their life or having an incredibly challenging moment that they're trying to navigate, often in a new country. El Paso might be their first introduction to the U.S. Whatever they might have seen in movies or TV shows, El Paso is what they see. And often organizations like Estrella are the first ones that they get connected with. So going into the programs, what is it that you want clients or potential clients or just people in these circumstances to feel as they are welcomed into Estrella?
I think the biggest thing is that we want to give them a sense of hope. There's so many sayings around the word hope, but like hope springs eternal. When we can find a legal avenue for somebody and give them that hope, from that hope, so much can come from it, right? For them personally, but then it gives us the opportunity to try and make a difference for them. I try to remind our team of that constantly, like, especially right now that it's so difficult, right? And the winds are not, you know, coming as frequently as they did before. They're more difficult. We have to fight a lot more. I try and remind everybody that, you know, the work that we do changes the life trajectory for people, not just for them, but for the generations that come after them. And for people, we want them to know that, like, we understand, again, the beauty of being on the border. Like, so many of us on our team have been through the process themselves. We've been through the process with our family members. We understand in a very unique way what people go through, which is, I think, very different from a lot of immigration attorneys in other parts of the country. Many of them, they have been through it themselves, but literally for us, it's our whole team. You know, most of us have been touched by this immigration issue in one way or another. What is wonderful about Estrella is that we come at the work from a place of love. And that's, I think, something that's really, really important. And that's my life motto, is that everything we do, that everything I do, I should do from a place of love.
No, I agree entirely. But one of the questions coming from that too is, you are a legal aid organization. So you have clients who are able to find some sort of avenue to relief, and then some who probably aren't. For varying reasons. But within that, how do you balance that legal side, like the very technical legal work that your team is doing, with the emotional weight, especially as you mentioned, you know, this is such a personal issue for so many of us who live on the border. You know, it makes it feel like that work is much more personal. So I'm wondering how you balance it yourself as a human being, but also as someone who's trying to lead an organization where obviously people are going through different things and the emotional weight of some of these cases is probably a lot to bear for one person. So what's that like?
I'll be honest, that's the hardest part, managing the emotional toll that comes with the work that we do. It's important for people, even when we don't have a legal avenue for them, to give them good information, because knowledge is power. And even when we do have legal options for them, you know, clients always ask us, like, well, what do I do? Like, make the decision for me. It's like, no, I can't make the decision for you. First of all, it's not my job. But two, I don't live in your shoes. So I think that's important for us to make sure that our team understands is that, you know, at the end of the day, we are limited by the law. And so there's only so much that we can do. But when we do have to give people bad news, it's really important to be as clear as possible in terms of the information that we're giving them and why we don't believe that they qualify. And two, I think to do it as respectfully and with care as we can. As much as the best thing I think we can do is give people hope, when you're taking away somebody's hope, that literally can crush somebody. So I think it's really important to do that with love. But I think the other piece of it is literally finding resources for people to turn to. For example, therapy. I do therapy on a regular basis, and I have been for years. So I have my own personal therapist. But then we also try and bring in different versions of self-care for the team. Like, for example, right now I'm trying to work on bringing some people in to spend a couple of days with the staff doing some work on self-care. And then I think talking about it is also really important. Like, I am very open with my feelings, and some people might think that that's a bad thing. People understand, like, when I'm struggling, they know that I'm struggling. Like, when I am, like, especially lately, the last month and a half or so, my mental health has been really, like, feels very precarious. If you come into my office and you see me looking a little down, like, that shouldn't stop you from still coming in and getting what you need. But I'm just, you know, struggling to find a balance in my mental health right now. And so I feel like being honest about that is also important.
Well, I, for one, do enjoy talking about my feelings too. So kudos to you for being open about that as well. I wanted to shift gears a little bit. Unfortunately, I did mention at the top that this would not be a conversation that focuses on policy. But I think when it comes to El Paso, and especially when it comes to the first Trump administration, El Paso became a major name or a major city in that effort to really try to reinforce the border. And it became a lab of cruelty. And I think one of the biggest ways that legal organizations especially came through yourselves and Las Americas was in 2018. And it was a part of a conversation that I had with Bob as well here, but I would love for us to zoom in a little bit more, which was the family separation crisis and policy of the first Trump administration. Obviously, that was an incredibly heavy time. So I do know that it could be something that is tough to bring up or might be difficult to think back to that time. But just what was it like on the ground as you were hearing the first either reports of it happening, and then kind of how do you respond to that in real time?
We've always known this, but El Paso is ground zero in terms of where policies start. Washington, D.C. loves to pilot policies in El Paso. We've always seen policies start here. I mean, this started back with Silvestre Reyes when he was the chief of the Border Patrol. He had a number of projects, but I will say, I think prior to 2016, we weren't really united as a community in terms of listening to not just the attorney groups, but also other groups about what they were hearing and seeing. So in 2016, we came together as a group in response to an ICE field office director who was making things very difficult for us here in El Paso. And so then when we started to see family separation, you know, it was officially acknowledged as a policy in April of 2018. We started seeing family separation in El Paso in the summer of 2017. But it was so early in the Trump administration. I mean, it was really, 6 months into the first Trump administration that people really weren't paying attention to El Paso. So as we're raising the red flags and trying to say, like, hey, guys, pay attention to us, nobody's listening. So we kind of started on our own, you know, tracking. We had a meeting with local DHS. I still remember it very distinctly at the Community Foundation Room downtown. Most of the DHS leadership locally was there, as well as a few Border Patrol agents. One of the Border Patrol agents, we brought up this family separation. One of the Border Patrol agents actually admitted that it was an official policy. And we were like, holy moly, we got them on the record about this. Like, we're thinking the next day we get a retraction from one of the Border Patrol attorneys. And so, you know, we're like, what in the world? And so we're trying to, again, trying to raise a red flag about this. Nobody's listening to us, but we're dealing with it. I mean, we're seeing families separated. You know, we're working with the Federal Public Defender's Office to try and locate children, because the craziest thing about the whole thing was that the way that the policy was deployed, they weren't keeping track of who was part of a household or who was part of a family. They were just separating people, but there was no way to track which child belonged to which adult or had entered with which adult. And so it created massive chaos. I mean, we had people languishing in federal custody because there were so many people going being prosecuted, and then who didn't know where their children were. And you know, real panic. And so us trying to, through, you know, the various systems and through the various orgs, really trying to come together to find a way. So as a result of that, then we see a huge increase in the number of unaccompanied children. So then we had the Tornillo facility that opened up, and we were the main service provider for the Tornillo facility. It was very like sequential in terms of this, like this thing started, family separation started. And as a result, we saw the kids in cages. And to be honest, and I've said this so much, the thing that saved us during the first Trump administration was COVID, because COVID saved us from a full year almost of additional policies on immigration. Had it not been for COVID, I can only imagine what other policies they would have rolled out. We did see, you know, MPP and people being, you know, stuck in Mexico, but that was part of a global pandemic, which kind of made things a little bit more complicated. But yeah, I think COVID, as terrible as that sounds, COVID saved us from more terrible policies.
I'm wondering if there are moments, cases that stayed with you from during that time that have gone on to impact the way that you work today? Or are there things from that time period that maybe the rest of the country doesn't fully understand to better give us a grasp on what we're experiencing now?
Yeah, I think unfortunately what stayed with people were the videos of like the masses of people. And that wasn't the reality day to day. I remember during, once COVID started, there were people living on the streets of El Paso right before Christmas. And then the president came in, that was then President Biden. President came into town to see what's happening in El Paso, and suddenly the streets are clean. I think what people outside of El Paso don't understand is that a lot of this is created mass hysteria and created media. And that the media has really, and I think that this is one thing that the administration is really good at, is turning, you know, a single photo and making it look like chaos, right? And so we've also developed better relationships with media to make sure that our story does get out. With the advent of social media and TikTok and, you know, those sound bites and those quick clips are what people are looking for. I hate to use the word, but right, like those videos of like thousands and thousands of people trying to enter the country, even though that's not accurate, is sexy, and sexy sells. That's what people are paying attention to. So I think we've become much more aware of the need to control the narrative and to make sure that our stories are getting out there and that our success stories and our reality is getting out there. And so I think, you know, things like this podcast are one of the things that are really important to making that a reality, is that it's not mass chaos. Like El Paso is still one of the safest cities in the country, and we have been for well over 20 years. You don't get that if you're living in a city of absolute chaos. Chicago has higher murder rates than we do. New York City has higher murder rates than we do. You know, Los Angeles has higher murder rates than we do. I remember at one point there was a bullet from Juarez that like landed at City Hall in El Paso, and that made like international news. Like little do people understand that like literally that was like a couple hundred feet because of where we are. And so I'm sure bullets hit city buildings and large cities regular, but it doesn't make international news. There's so much joy in this community and so much joy in our immigrant communities. And we want people to see that. We don't just want to see the doom and gloom and like, oh, this is terrible and this is overwhelming. I love that this thing that keeps that's making the rounds lately, like if you don't like immigrants and you can't eat their food, I think it was Trevor Noah that said it. It's like, if you don't like Mexicans and no more Mexican food for you.
No, absolutely. I feel like the world would not survive without our food there. Think now that what we're seeing in terms of politics all along the border too, not just El Paso, but it seems like some of these narratives, for as welcoming of a city as I think most of us are, that there is some of that sentiment that's starting to creep in. And I was talking to Dr. Leyva about it, and it terrifies me. It makes me a little bit sad and a little bit scared that our city might become less welcoming. But then hearing you talk about it, then it kind of reminds me that no, our city has always been like this and will continue to be like this. But has it been a challenge as well, even here in El Paso, is pushing back on that narrative?
I don't think that people are feeling that way more than they have before. Mm-hmm. I think what it is that the administration has given people a platform and a right to be okay in having those views. So I remember a friend and I having this conversation during law school about how it seems like autism was everywhere now. Like so many kids are being diagnosed with autism now, and like the occurrences of autism are on the rise. And I remember telling this friend, well, I don't think that it's that more kids are being born with autism. I think what it is that there's more awareness of the issue. And with social media, you know, people are understanding, they're seeing the signals. There's more awareness of the issue. And I kind of feel the same way with this. I think social media gives everybody a platform. I'm not a fan of social media for the way that it's been manipulated. But like growing up, like when I was in middle school, if somebody was going to, you know, talk about you or say something, they had to literally come up to you and say something to you, right? Yeah. Like they couldn't sit behind a computer. I was looking at some comments today, some negative comments on one of our posts, and I clicked on on some of the responses. And one of them, the person doesn't even live in El Paso. Mm-hmm. Like the person lives in like Florida. But I feel like social media gives people a platform. And so in my heart of hearts, I you know, still believe that El Paso is the welcoming city and will continue to be the welcoming city. Are people more aware of the challenges? Yes, absolutely they are. But I think it's then even more incumbent upon us to make sure that we explain those things away. And so I try to make myself available to people who have questions about immigration issues, and we talk about them and they're like, oh, that's not what I understood. And I'm like, okay, well, let me explain to you how it works and what the reality is, having those conversations. So I think it's incumbent upon us to make sure that our city remains as welcoming as it is.
What role can people take in these border communities in shaping not just the narrative, but actually starting to think through policy changes? Like, how can we get folks who aren't from here to better understand this so that we can get policies that don't just use our cities as like backdrops for cruelty? What role do we have, do you think?
I think we play a critical role. I think one mistake that Washington has made time and time again is that they develop these laws and these systems without involving the people who work and live in these systems on a day-to-day basis. Immigration attorneys are some of the best people that can tell you what the flaws in the system are. I bet you could ask, you could pull 100 of us and we could give you instantly a number of solutions that would very quickly, you know, erase some of the backlogs and some of the delays in the system. And so I think the role that we play is to really think about the ways to make the system better, because as the system has been broken down, the hope that we have is that we can build it back up and build it better than it's ever been. So we have that responsibility. I think it's incumbent upon us to really take this time to think through what do we want our new systems to look like, and then make sure that, you know, Congresswoman Escobar knows where we are on those things, and that, like, for example, we try to make ourselves available to her and to her team so that they know, okay, these are the things that we're seeing right now, and these are the ways that we could potentially fix them. Or if questions come down, we want to make sure that she has access to the experts in the area who can give her not just a legally sound answer, but also can give her a perspective based on what we're seeing along the border. So I think that's really important, is we have to make our voices heard, because if Washington is again where a new system is built, we're going to find ourselves in the same spot 20 years from now, 30 years from now.
It's hard to imagine. And that's essentially my question to you before I let you go, is what does Estrella look like? What does the work look like 10, 15, 20 years? Where do we go from here? And also, if people listening want to support the work that Estrella does, where, how can they start to do that, and where can they find y'all?
For us, we've had a lot of really big challenges this year funding-wise. We started almost a year ago to the day with a staff of 101, and we are down to a staff of 60. So we've had tremendous funding challenges this year, but I think we've also shown our resilience as an organization, and we're committed to fighting for as long as we need to fight to make a system better for all of us, because we believe very strongly that immigrants fulfill our lives and that they bring so much joy and love and good food and culture and language. My hope is that in 10 or 20 years, we will have grown back to where we were before. But the biggest thing is that we're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
They can't scare us away from the work. Are we taking precautions? Absolutely we are. Are we being more, being more thoughtful about how we do certain things? Absolutely, 100%. But that doesn't mean that they can scare us away from doing this work. The way that people can support, the biggest thing is social media. I talked about the narrative. Please find us on social media. We're on LinkedIn. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook. We do also have a Blue Sky account. So find us on those platforms, Estrella del Paso. If you just search Estrella del Paso, you can go to our website, www.estrella.org. And there's a donate button if you're so inclined to support us financially. We are very much appreciative of that.
And hopefully that'll make people want to visit us here too in our lovely border.
Yes.
All right. Melissa Lopez, Executive Director of Estrella del Paso. Thank you so much for joining us and for your time today. I really appreciate it. And that was Melissa Lopez, Executive Director at Estrella del Paso. I want to thank Melissa first for her time and our conversation. I learned so much, but also want to thank Melissa and her team for the work that they do day in and day out. And I'll be honest, I think after a conversation like that, it feels like one of those moments where you don't want to rush to say anything. You want to really take stock and listen to what Melissa talked about what it means to welcome people with dignity, showing up. That's the everyday work that Estrella does, along with other organizations and countless volunteers around the city. It's people making hard decisions in real time for their clients, often not having the certainty that things will always work out. It's heavy work. So I just want to thank Melissa again for sharing some of that. And I really want us to just take some time to think back across our entire Borderly series and really look at the ideas that we explored and expressed from different angles: history, memory, art, living within the law and systems that are in place. But underneath all of it was El Paso, not as a symbol, but as a place. It's a real city with real people who carry these burdens and these issues long after the attention moves on. And at least for me, this project started here in El Paso because it had to. El Paso, for me, is home. It's where I grew up. It's the place that made me the person that I am. And I think it's also an important place where conversations about migration, belonging, and care aren't theoretical. They're personal for all of us. They're a part of our story here. But I also realize now, through these stories that we've heard, is that this is not only an El Paso story. I think we're all well aware that borders exist everywhere, between countries, of course, but also between cultures and languages and histories, and often even within ourselves. And everywhere that there's a border, there are people doing the quiet work of keeping these communities together and keeping those stories alive. So again, as I mentioned, this is our last episode, our last chapter of Borderly for now, but I hope it doesn't feel like an ending, but maybe more like a pause, a chance now to take a step back, listen to the stories that we've learned a lot from, and think about where these conversations might take you, might take us, perhaps to other border regions, other parts of the world, other stories that deserve the same care and the same attention. And if you've heard Borderly and you're listening from El Paso, I just want to thank you so much. I want you to know how much El Paso means to me and how much I love this city. I think this city is really the heartbeat of this project. And if you're listening from somewhere else, I hope these conversations stick with you regardless of where you might be, and that they gave you a new perspective on what it means to be from the border, or even on the word border itself, even if just a little bit. But I want to sign off now and thank you so much for joining me on this journey, and we'll see where this story leads us in the future. But this is Mario Carrillo signing off as your host of Borderly, a project of Immigrantly. Our episode was produced by Saria Han, editorial review by Shea Yu, sound design, theme music, and editing by Lou Raskin, and other music by Epidemic Sound. And we'll see where the next story begins. Thank you so much.